You know what I used to do? I used to keep it in the dining room, or in the living room by my couch. And if there was something came on TV that I wanted, I immediately slapped that on. Mm-hmm. And I'd play it back and listen to a speech several times. Mm-hmm. And you get the full benefit of and you'd be surprised when you listen to a speech 3-4 times how much more you get out of it. For example, I'm going down to a meeting tonight on jobs, the military, and a few other subjects going to be discussed by an ex-newspaper publisher that was from this town. And he and I serve on a board here. I spoke against the Vietnamese War down at West Virginia University when it was very unpopular to stand up and be heard. And the day that I went down there, they brought 50 state troopers into town, all the big guys. And every time I opened my mouth, they opened theirs into a walkie-talkie. And I often wonder, I should have checked out my record in D.C. because of the Freedom of Information Act. Because, you know, I contributed to the Berrigan Brothers and that. Mm-hmm. I've been involved in some other, you know. And this publisher wrote me a personal letter telling me how proud he was that somebody from our valley would stand up and say the things that I said and wasn't afraid to be heard, you know. And all I talked with was plain, simple, honest logic. The newspaper carried it. And it was controversial with some people because they had kids in the army. And I told them, of all the people that should be opposed to it should be them. I shouldn't be the one. But I was a veteran, and I was wounded 5 times. Mm-hmm. So nobody tells me, well, nobody ever brought up my past or whatever, because most of them know it. I also got the Distinguished Service Cross in the infantry for foot soldier. You know, they don't pass them out. So, in other words, your patriotism can't be questioned, and there has to be some sound logic and concern because, you know, I don't have children, I'm not married. I didn't have to do that. But I could see that it was stupid and foolish, and I spent a night with Robin Moore, the guy that wrote the Green Beret, and when he told me what he'd seen and went through, and it was a lot of things that was never in the book, that's whenever I says, hey. And he never once said the war was right or wrong. But I thought, if this is what it's about, then it's absolutely idiotic, asinine. And you know, nobody ever said why we were there. But you know what it was. The natural resources of that country, their wealth.
And now they're spoiled. They're completely spoiled.
You know what? You've heard the old expression, ruler ruin, wrecker ruin, you know. They claim there's an awful lot of oil off the Vietnamese coast in the China Sea. And you know, these companies, and this, you know, they belong to no country. Exxon, Amoco, Gulf, and all, they belong to no country. I don't know how many ships, flags or ships fly under. They're opportunists that are out to make money. Mm-hmm. And you know, that the youth and the manhood of the country should be wasted. And what do you get out of it, you know? You know, whenever they were talking about what was happening over in Iran, and they were saying, are this and are that, I says, hey, I don't know a damn thing over there. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know nothing. And As far as these people that work there, I think any time you go out of a country in another country, there's a certain element of danger. And if you took that job, you're it. And I see where they want to give them $5,500 for and 444 days and they're not satisfied. If I had my way, they wouldn't get 55 cents. They were paid for being there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, soldiers were captured and treated badly, abused. They didn't get nothing extra. And they were fighting for the country, representing it. These people had good jobs. You know, real gravy. And that's why they were there. Because they live high on the hog. Well, I don't know.
You said something about the kind of scrambling people go through in the labor movement. What kind of background makes people want that when most of the time they do have lost?
I don't know. You know, I think quite a few times the company makes their adversary.
Oh,
in the first place, they have to hire you in order for you to work for them.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have to misuse or abuse you, and that riles you up. And then you got to work somewhere, and you figure you may as well fight where you're at. And in my case, I got up on the floor of the union hall one time and made a statement. I can't remember what it was. It was a strong statement that criticized some people. And one of them was a great, big, huge guy, weighed about 270. He looked down at me and says, "Keep your mouth shut or I'll throw you down them steps." I said, "Well, you try it." I said, "You don't worry me." And I got up and I spoke and I crucified him. And I decided, well, I'm going to run for office. People like him or whatever. And ultimately, him and I got into a fist fight. And it must have looked funny. And the funny part of it is, he never laid a hand on me. Badly. I just worked on his insides underneath and he kept swinging and missing. And then I drove an uppercut into his nose and busted and went up between his eyes and his both eyes closed. And people were just shocked. They couldn't believe it. I couldn't either. But I was so mad I didn't care what happened. So anyway, that's how I got into it. And kept seeing and hearing things, and whenever I saw something or heard something that was wrong, I'd go to the guy and say, "Hey, you can't allow that company to do that. Put a stop to it. Make a case and I'll take it up." You know, like back in those days, you were loading with a shovel and you wouldn't want to work in a place you wasn't satisfied with what they offered you to work in. So they'd tell you, "Well, there it is, take it or leave it." And then they'd say, "Lou, you go down there and work in that place." Or they'd tell a motorman, "Give him all the cars he wants. So somebody would be greedy and they'd load in their place and run over there. And that was extra. And I'd go to them and I'd say, "Hey, you took an oath never to wrong a brother or see him wrong and to help him out when he's in adversity. And you're violating that oath. That guy refused to work here. You should have asked why is that place there. You didn't even have to ask. You knew there was something wrong." "Well, I didn't notice that." "You just tell them to stick them cars. Nobody's going to look that place." And things such as that. In
my life, one of the most, in my opinion, important cases I ever won, and I did it in spite of the union or the district or whatever, was an unemployment compensation case, because it was the case that established the precedent. And it was a case involving my father, he retired, and he kept on my back all the time. He was entitled to unemployment compensation.
And were you a union officer at the time?
I was a committee, but I wasn't working at his mine. I worked across the river. Anyway, to get him off of my back, I came home without washing. Met him down at the unemployment office so I'd get there before they closed. So I asked them why they had turned him away. They says, he quit work, he can't get it. I says, you can't tell him that. I says, you gotta go through a certain procedure. Yeah, but it's a waste of time. I says, well, that's your opinion. I said, that's not our opinion. So that evening, I met with a guy that interviewed me at the office, and he gave me some clues about how I should go about doing what he knew I wanted to do. And he said, he admired my father for all the years he worked and everything. He was all broken up and humped up and everything. Felt sorry for him, and he felt that it wasn't justifiable to do what they were doing, cutting back. So I took my dad to a doctor. The doctor examined him, found him in fair health for a guy his age. Then he wanted to know, well, what's this all about? I said, well, would you write that down on a paper? And he got scared. He said, what's it all about? I says, well, it so happens that he couldn't work at that job anymore. But my father could do other work, and they don't have it. And he says, well, what could he do? I said, well, he could run an elevator or run a motor, streetcar. So the Mrs. Okay, so he filled it out. Suitable light work. So when we went down to the unemployment office, they didn't accept that. They said, well, you know there ain't no jobs like that around. I said, well, whose fault is that? It ain't our fault. I said, you want to know what he could do? I gave you a couple examples. So we went, we had a hearing for a referee, and I didn't know any better. I only used common sense, and we won the case. And after that, I took every guy from my local, I took them in groups, and they all collected unemployment. And the district didn't want to believe that they could get it. That was their job. God knows the money that was lost by them. But that's how those things, that's how a guy gets into it. Then his anger at his own union officials, who are worse than management sometimes, who think that, you know, they forget where they come from and they think that you work for them. And not the reverse. And at that time they had cliques and so forth. And what the heck, they're in a position where they can bribe people. It's different today, because if somebody sees something that's a violation, they know more about what's right and what's wrong. They were never next to it before. They never knew what rights they had. They can hold an officer And that's how that money...
Not with us, but in some other money shifting, wound up in Tennessee and up to Cleveland, paying the murders of Jackie Blonsky and his wife and daughter.
How?
Well, they shifted this money around. They give it to the pensioners on a pretext of going out and picketing or whatever. And they had them endorse the checks. In other words, I give you the check, you sign it, you hand it back to me. I don't know what kind of people they were that were doing all those things. Then they converted it back to cash. And the cash went back to D.C. And D.C. sent someone out and gave the cash to someone else to go up there. And it's what you call laundering money. The racketeers do it by going into legitimate business or whatever. I don't know. Now, what else can we say?
Just what are, in general, and then maybe even to sum up, what are some of the links you see between religion and labor?
Well, let me say, I don't know about links. My church was active, both in the Depression, when unions were being formed and organized, and especially in the South. The vice president of the United Church of Christ is a man named Sprague. He's still around, and he was involved in that. Our church participated down in Harlan County when this Duke Power affair was on. I can only speak for our church because I didn't see anybody else. And I understand that out in the West, our church was one of the ringleaders. I don't know if any other churches got involved. Got together with the ranchers, told them that when they take out the coal, they're going to lose their water and their land would become barren and desert, which is true. And that if they talk about getting the right-of-way on slurry, and that's using the right of eminent domain across the country, that would have to be pushed by water. And to get that kind of water, they'd barren the West, you know. And doing it with religious groups is far better because it gives more credibility to it than it would be by doing it with the average people, because they always inject that red herring, you know. They tell you they're communist or whatever. And, you know, it has nothing to do with it. But you can hardly throw that kind of a charge against the church. Although they have said that about Father Rice.
Yeah.
You know, and what would life be if you didn't have people like him, him and McIlvain, to stand up and speak out in behalf of the little people? I think Father Rice is just one heck of a guy. The only thing is that he gets himself into too many different things and he kind of wears thin.
I think he loves to get into all those
things. Oh, absolutely. He and I are pretty good friends.
That's good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I enjoy being with him. But there's not too many Father Rices around. And, you know, instead of them preaching from the pulpit on behalf of capitalism and capitalists and all that, and being so concerned about them, that would show a little more compassion and concern for that little working guy. And I'm not talking about guys that are, you know, making a bundle. There are an awful lot of people that are non-union that are forced to accept whatever crumbs fall. And they have to raise families. And I have nothing but compassion for people that are poor and raising kids, especially today, if they're decent kids. Because it's a terrible hardship to watch everybody getting all kinds of things and wearing the best clothes and so forth and not having it and making a kid feel like he's inferior, second class or something. Imagine what this does to girls. You know, if they feel inferior, what are they going to get? They're going to get some inferior guy. Or they'll go out and become prostitutes or something. Because they feel inferior. The only way they can feel they're going to get their superiority is to have a dollar or whatever. You know. And the boys, the same way. So what are they going to do? They'll go out and just do strange things, including stealing, robbing, dope, and so on. And I think it's horrible. And I think that that should come from the church, the pulpit. You know, I think that they should tell the people that they're getting shafted, and if they need help, how to get it, and how to organize, or why they should organize. Because, you know, a lot of this prosperity, in large part, is due to the unions, because people got their share of the profits, or part of their share. And they, in return, gave certain concessions to the company. You know, productivity is the real key to it all, but industry has to look at their own house and see the inept supervisory forces that they've got, and not blame, you know, put the blame on the working man. After all, he just takes orders. If they're not running right. A lot of guys that work for companies see things, tell somebody, and they're told to keep their mouth shut. I've seen things in a mine where it was so stupid. And it ultimately costs time, and time means money. You know. And maybe they ought to have, it might cost the company a little money to have a get together with the members once in a while and ask for their opinions, or to tell them what they don't like or what aggravates them or what rubs them. Because if you eliminate all that friction, you know, everything's smooth and things go better. You know, the secret to the productivity in Japan was given by a guy named Griffith that was an American that went over there and showed him how, you know, what kind of rapport there should be between the worker and the company. And, you know, they wouldn't listen to him in this country. And they still won't. They can't conceive of being so generous. Those people have jobs for life. And companies are diversified. In other words, when the goose that lays the golden egg dies, you've got another goose waiting to take its place. Or it's laying them beside them. That you don't put all your eggs in one basket. But you can't seem to tell these people. Just like automobiles, you know. I remember right after World War II, with the Legion magazine and the VFW magazine talked about foreign cars, how good they were. Said that we better take notice because it's going to affect us. As the years went on, there's less parking space here, more pollution, so on and so forth. All this is ignored, and they continue to make the big cars even today. And they're crying like heck about foreign imports. Hey, people are not getting what they want here, so they're buying it from over there. And why shouldn't they? They're not obligated to buy here. And then when they get the little people pointing fingers at each other, you know, you so-and-so, you buy a foreign car. Well, why shouldn't you? You earn that money. Why shouldn't your companies, who you subsidize, Chrysler,
mm-hmm.
Why didn't they make these little cars? And why ain't they doing it now? You know, it's bull. And they still don't want to give you what you want. Now what right are they making 300 and some and 400 and some horsepower motors to put under a darn flimsy car that's going to kill you and a couple other people? You know, why all this, and why burn up all that energy, and why pollute all that air? You know, these little Datsun and the Volvo and the Volkswagen and Toyota, hell, they've all proved that you don't need, and hey, they purr up that highway too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there should be some restrictions. They have to have big cars, let it be for the law.
Why would they need them?
Well, the cops need a big car so you can chase and catch these guys and so to hold the road. And I wouldn't even let government officials run around in them big ones. You know?
I know.
Because you know what they'd do. You know, I heard a lot about the Senate building in that restaurant and all that, and how cheap it was to eat there and so forth. And I thought, yeah, and they're just the ones that need it. Free haircuts, cheap food, cheap gasoline, you know, what the heck. And they're the ones that are plucking our meat off of our bones.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the sad part about, in my opinion, the country today is the people that you send to represent you turn out to be thieves and scoundrels. And they're concerned more about lobbyists than grease in their palm, and I guess that comes from the companies. And they want to swing the pendulum back the other way again, and it is going that way. This Reagan bunch, you know, they just seem to be down on everybody.
Maybe they'll do the same thing the companies do for the labor movement. Maybe they'll make us organize and oppose them.
Well, the question is how long? You know, Reagan only wants to hurt the little people. You know, whenever, do you recall when they, what did they do? They did something. Anyway, they had one, that was the last date of deadline on their budget or something. And they stayed up all night arguing and fighting over 40 million or billion or 17 billion, I can't recall. Because of the fact that they said that the oil companies needed that money to do the oil companies never asked for it. Nobody knows who the hell asked for it. But the sad part was that they were trying to cut out Social Security, cut back on it. And I'm gonna make a remark about some nuns in a minute that were involved in that. Nobody asked for that.
Okay. Before you make that, I'm gonna turn this over.